We started this journey at the beginning, the Indigenous origin story and the acknowledgement that there is a before and after. We're talking, of course, about before the Europeans arrived and then after they settled here. As we talk about this, I'm going to acknowledge once again that we are on the traditional, ancestral and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. That is usually the very first thing uttered from any podium at any event in Canada, a land acknowledgement. We say out loud whose land we are on and we give thanks for the use of this land. This, of course, is all based on the language of treaties. So let's start with that session now. Phil and Kathleen, this is a fascinating element to the whole history. And I suppose if you don't understand treaties, you don't understand the history of Canada. So let's try and help everybody understand, better understand it. Give me the story, if you can, Phil, of how the first treaties, they sort of warmed Indigenous people to the notion of it.
Well, one thing is very clear when we talk about treaty making, negotiating treaties. Our people knew and understood very well that the world was changing, that it would never be the same. And so they had to figure out how they were going to give life to their communities, how they were going to protect their children, what it is that they were going to be able to extract from the crown, the Queen Mother. And that's how these treaties began. And so you had early treaties in the East, but our people in the West knew that treaties were being negotiated. There were no secrets about this very important matter.
Did it sound like a good thing? Or did they know right away?
Oh, gosh, our people thought that the treaties were really very important. And they represented a lot of good to their people and their communities. And so when the commissioners announced that they would be, say, in Lower Fort Garry July and August, and that they would like to meet with the Indians of the various tribes in the region to talk treaty, the people showed up, their leaders showed up, and they're prepared to sit down and negotiate something for their future, about their future. The fact that the world is changing, as I noted, and it would never be the same, right? So they had these discussions over very complicated matters. And they resolved these issues in a matter of days, a very short period of time. These legal documents that were written in British legalese, English legalese, and not in our languages. So we had interpreters that didn't always provide the kind of clarity and translation about what was being said, what was being proposed. But our people understood that it was about land. There was some issue of money. There was some issue of the future in terms of what kind of life that they would be able to provide for themselves. Since the buffalo had just about ceased to exist, the beaver had disappeared, all fur-bearing animals and their fur had been depleted. So they had to think of another life. And this other life had to do with what was going to be described in the treaty. Most importantly, the Indians said, we want to acquire the cunning of the white man. What was that? The ability to read and write. That's why most indicated that one of the promises was a schoolhouse. The schoolhouse had to be built at the behest of the chief of this tribe or that tribe.
And that, of course, opened a whole new crisis, mm-hmm. which we will get to. But Kathleen, I, this is an awkward position I'm going to put you in, but be the crown here mm-hmm. at that negotiating table and tell me about the clash of perceptions, if you will.
Sure. Well, the crown approached these treaties as massive real estate deals, where they could acquire all of this land for a very cheap price, so that settlers and investors could come and exploit the land. That was their main objective in the treaty making. On the other side of the table, as Phil has said, the indigenous people came with a different perspective. They wanted a future for themselves, their kids, their grandchildren, etc. They wanted to protect their culture, language. They wanted health care. They wanted education. They weren't stupid people. They knew what they needed in order to survive and thrive. So there was these two competing perceptions. And further to make the situation even more separate in terms of perception was the language barrier. There was the notion that from the indigenous side that treaties were sacred, that the verbal expressions of what they wanted, the spirit and intent of this bargain, was much more important than the written word. That was how treaties historically were made, and people honored those. And so when they presented wampum belts or gifts or had the ceremony, that was to ratify, in a sense, the moral aspect of these agreements. On the other side, the British wanted to write it all down because they knew that perhaps they'd end up in court one day, and they wanted the words there. They wanted this to be like a contract that was enforceable by law. But whose law? The Crown's law, the colonial law. And so British law versus indigenous law was the crux of the matter here and was the problem in difference of perceptions. They were like two ships passing in the night in terms of where they were coming from. However, I would think the British knew what they were doing quite clearly.
In financial terms, what did Indigenous peoples get in return?
They were promised so much land, and quite often, the land that the commissioners were prepared to offer the people they were negotiating with, the various tribes, was never what the Indians wanted.
Land to hunt, to farm?
Well, they were supposed to be able to sustain themselves till the end of time with their traditional pursuits, hunting, fishing, trapping, in addition to all of these other matters that I've mentioned, to be able to farm, to educate their children, and of course, cash. In terms of annual annuities, so much for the chief, so much for the head of the council, and so much for the ordinary folk. And in my case, I'm not a chief. I'm not a, you know, I don't hold a political title in my community of Saguin, but I still receive $5 a year for the fact that I belong to Treaty number one.
Still to this day.
Yeah, August 3rd, 1871, that's what we were promised. That's what we received today.
So how does that show up today? This is something negotiated that long ago.
It is seen as being completely unfair, totally unfair. And our leadership firmly believe that the commissioners lied to them when they were told you would get the land you need to be able to sustain yourself, you'll get cash, you'll get farm implements, you'll get a school. But the land that was offered them was not of the quantity or volume that would enable them to sustain themselves. And of course, they felt deprived of what was rightfully theirs. And so complaints started the day after that the treaty was unfair. They promised this, they never delivered that. And for example, in treaty number one, there's a add-on called outside promises. And there were not much in those days. Right, the outside promises, the buggy and whatnot, but today they are significant because you have to be able to translate the language of 1871 to the language of 2023. And to make it, to make some sense out of that, you know what? So what have we been able to deliver, both sides, in terms of peaceful coexistence? Peaceful coexistence between commissioners and the people they represented and our people. It's been nothing but conflict, right? Our people calling on the government to give them the land they promised them over 120 years ago, 100 years ago, to give them the implements that they promised them, to give them the cash that they said they would provide. As times changed, as the economy, the Canadian economy changed, that this would be reflected in terms of what the various tribes would receive from the Canadian government. That's why we're still besieged as a country with resolving land issues.
There are so many examples of where obviously the European mindset was never going to see Indigenous peoples as equals. Let's have a deeper understanding of some of the tactics that were in fact life-threatening tactics that were imposed on reserves.
Well, one example that comes to mind is in terms of the transition to agriculture, the farming. And in Manitoba, in the western part of the province, our people were so very successful at farming, the white farmers complained to the government. Government moved in and made it extremely difficult for the success to continue. And withholding implements, farming implements and the like. And in effect, forcing people into starvation because they couldn't do as the government wanted them to be initially when they were negotiating treaties, for example, offering them farming implements, agricultural implements, so that they could make a transition from being hunters, particularly, and trappers, into farmers. And yet, it was near impossible for our people to become successful at that economic pursuit. Rather, the government wanted them to be farmhands.
And this isn't just oral history. This is actually
a written down
principle.
Sure.
So, Kathleen, give us the background of the fact that this was not something happening in the shadows.
No. Well, in fact, I went to school with a friend, a high school in Trail, BC, where I'm from. Her grandfather, Edgar Dewdney, was the man responsible for the government policy of reward and punishment. And if the Indigenous community was doing something the government didn't like with respect to the settlers and their economy, they would punish them. The punishment could be food rations being denied. The punishment could be seizing their weapons so they couldn't hunt. The punishment could be not providing, as Phil said, the agricultural implements they would need to continue to be successful farmers. So people starved. And this was also in the context of treaty making. All of this was happening around the same time. So not only was there this perception problem of the Indigenous people seeing treaties as a sharing agreement, sharing the land for prosperity for both, sharing resources, whereas the government saw it as a real estate deal. Now what we had was inequality of bargaining power completely, because when people are starving or people are disease ridden, because not only did the newcomers bring goods to trade, they also brought disease that Indigenous people didn't have the natural resistance for. So there was thousands of Indigenous people died of smallpox, the flu, tuberculosis, all sorts of diseases. So you had this going on in the community that they're entering into these huge agreements, or these agreements with huge implications, I should say. They weren't huge agreements, they were like two pagers. So, you know, you had this tremendous inequality of bargaining power, this tremendous misconception of perception. And today, even with the modern treaties, we have the same problem with perception and attitudes and intention. The spirit and intent which Indigenous people enter into these agreements with, of sharing the resources, sharing the wealth, and the Crown's view of control and certainty for third-party investors, like the oil companies, like the pipeline companies. They're not going to invest if they don't have a treaty or they don't have a legal thing they can take to court and have judges enforce. Judges operating from colonial legal principles, of course. So the deck is stacked against the Indigenous people from the get-go, and always has been.
And then, so now today, you try and achieve a fair and just resolution of these matters. For example, land. It's near impossible to achieve success because the government is still of the mindset of the old time, of olden times, right? And we have to pull out all stops to convince government negotiators that this is fair, this is unfair, the judge was wrong here, the judge was wrong here. And it's really frustrating, nearly debilitating, in terms of securing what is right and just for our people. It's a sad tale, really. And
it's 2023, mm-hmm. and the fight continues. Mm-hmm.
And it's all about access now, as it was back then, access for mining interests, for oil and gas, logging interests,
hydroelectric
power. Major farming operations, and essentially, Indian lands were open for business, right? There were no rules that governed mining companies, for example, or particularly mining companies, for access to Indian lands so that they could go out and explore and prospect.
When I think about, you know, in the Irish culture, the Irish famine is something we all know the story of. We know it through oral history, we know it through facts, through history. Can you give us some kind of historical perspective on stories you may have heard growing up on what that starvation on those farms, when the herds were disappearing, stories that may have carried into your life that you learned as a small child?
Well, I'll give you one story. It's embedded in my memory. And this is a story about the Indian agent ruling, according to edicts that were set out by government in Ottawa and in Winnipeg, the major center for Indian agencies in Manitoba. And this was in the period of high unemployment in our community. Men were desperate for work. Fishing wasn't the economy it used to be. Hunting wasn't something that our people did as they used to. And trapping was for few. Government had come in and introduced the permit system. So people had to have a trap line here or a trap line there that had to be conferred on them by government. So we became really dependent on welfare, social assistance. And it was quite often the men in the early days that had to go to the Indian office in town to seek social assistance, to get welfare from the Indian agent. And this guy made a decision. Okay, if you have the money to be able to drive to town, why do you have to come here for welfare? And there'd be this long lineup of men on the street of this town, right up to the Indian agent's office. And it was, and he was insisting that these people that had cars, that they bring in their license plates, right? Before he would have the will to give them what was rightfully theirs. So it was humiliating. It was like I don't know how you'd describe the feeling or the feelings of the men that had to be seek financial support so that they could sustain their families, and put through the humiliation of convincing the Indian agent that, you know, they had a few bucks, that's how they came into town to get support from the government. Someone had to be a stone heart. Someone had to have a stone heart to compel him to implement these rules that were so completely unfair, right? Completely objectionable to any fair-minded person.
And this is also why the concept of building trust after so much is lost is so difficult and takes so long.
You don't believe government when it makes a decision, or when government gives you its word that they will behave this way to you or to the people, right? Because too often, the opposite is true. And this image that I have in my mind about the people and from my community going to the Indian agent and asking this bastard, right, this awful bastard to provide what was rightfully theirs, right? People in need of help, in need of support. Not because they were lazy, right? They weren't beggars, but they had no other option and then to go to the government, as many peoples in the history of this country have had to do, is to go to government to sustain their families and their communities. That's history.
After the government made it impossible for them to thrive. So this was the catch-22, of course. So yeah, it brings tears to one's eyes to think about this. In terms of our idea that we're a country that respects dignity, or we're told this, and equality, and we believe in human rights. This is not human rights. This is human degradation, deliberate, to degrade and subordinate a whole race of people.
And the document that really drives all of this is the Indian Act. 1876, the Indian Act, and other than a few amendments, it remains essentially the same today.
Well, it's no coincidence that the Indian Act shortly followed the beginning of this treaty making. So the Indian Act became the legal instrument, the enforceable legal instrument that would control people on reserves now, because the treaties were putting people on reserve. So you have to look at, what does the Indian Act say? Well, the Indian Act, clearly its purpose was to totally assimilate and control and destroy the indigenous culture.
Go one step further, because I think it's so severe when you read the language of what those reserves did and whether or not people were even allowed to leave them.
Oh yeah, they had a pass system. So the Indian agent, who was a non-indigenous person, was put on every single reserve, and they were the police, basically, of the Indian Act. And so if you wanted to leave the reserve, you had to show a pass or get permission. That was just one thing. But I mean, the Indian Act, it did all sorts of things. It took away the system of governance that indigenous people had and replaced it with an election type of governance with a chief and council. It took away the right of women to participate in the governance. It took away cultural activities like powwows and sun dances.
Banned them.
It banned them.
By law.
It required children to go to Indian residential schools. What's interesting on the land question, which again is clearly no coincidence, it forbade indigenous people from raising money to fight these land grabs and theft of land and failure to adhere to the principles of the treaty. They could not raise money to fight them, and furthermore, they could not hire a lawyer to help them. In fact, we have one case that Phil and I are involved in where a lawyer tried for a number of years to help this community, which was illegally amalgamated, and he got a letter from the government saying he would be disbarred if he continued to act for these people. So that's how the Indian Act worked. It's almost unbelievable that these laws could stand. And for women, it was terribly disadvantageous for women. And this feeds into the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls issue. Women were downgraded. They were put at the very bottom of this social ladder.
And especially for a community that had such a matriarchal strength,
sure,
historically.
And the women's role in the fur trade was massive. But all of a sudden, women couldn't participate in the governance. They were not considered to be active or important members. They were, the residential schools sort of assigned them to be people that would do beadwork only and that would be homemakers and that would not have any significance in the community. So they also would lose their status. Their status was totally tied to men. So if an Indian woman, or I'm using the term Indian because it's under the Indian Act, if an Indian woman married a non-status Indian or a non-native person, she lost her status. Her kids lost their status. They were no longer under the Indian Act, which had other benefits, which allowed her to live on a reserve, which allowed her to be even buried on the reserve. They took all of that away if she dared to step out of the male dominance of her identity. And that lasted, frankly, till 2019, when finally, after several court cases going all the way to the United Nations, finally the Canadian government, just a few years ago, said that we finished with all the gender discrimination under the Indian Act, and now they cannot deny status based on who you marry. So, in the generations, they had all sorts of provisions about, well, if you married out and you were denied status, fine, you and your kids. Well, then that was changed. But then if your grandchildren married out, well, then they were denied. So it just went on and on. So, you know, the remnants of the Indian Act are still disadvantageous, right up until recently, for women especially.
And we really need to dig into this because this is still the document today. But Phil, before we do that, can you give us your earliest memory of an Indian agent on your reserve? Do you have memories of that? That relationship between this outsider, basically, who came onto your reserve and their impact?
Well, one part of it is funny, because the Indian agent stopped on the road in front of our house, and there's a bottle of beer on the, empty, mind you, on the table. And might have been my mother had said, hey, hide that. The Indian agent Frank Hughes is coming.
And do you remember his name?
Yeah, I do. And put away the bannock, you know, so yeah, the bannock wasn't for white people.
And tell me why, though. Obviously, there was a fear. If your mother felt if the agent saw the beer or the bannock, there was going to be judgment.
Oh, gosh, yeah. But interestingly enough, my parents had high regard for Frank Hughes. He wasn't an overbearing kind of person, right? That imposed the laws as outlined in the Indian Act. He was more reasonable.
But what was he doing at your house? What was his normal?
Well, I think he was coming
role
to check up on us. I don't know. We didn't have any. We didn't hold any special status in the community. But he he decided, I guess, to stop and see what was happening in the Fontaine homestead. And when he was done, he drove off. But interestingly enough, I don't think he was the one, but I couldn't tell you the name. The Indian agent had to give permission to my father, who was selling some of his cattle so he could buy a car. So the Indian agent had to come out and, with my father, count the cattle, the number of cattle that were going to be sold. And that was just the way it was done.
So he couldn't do any business decision without the approval of the Indian agent.
And the Indian agent had an overbearing presence in the lives of our people. And he didn't live on the reserve, the Indian agent. There, he had an office in town, second floor of the post office. But before then, he had been in Selkirk. So the Indian agent, while he had all of this power and control, didn't have a presence where everyone on the reserve knew who he was, right?
But then when you became chief of your reserve at a very young age, you fired him, right?
I didn't fire him.
I booted him.
Who, Frank?
No, Frank. Oh. Frank, I probably would have been a friend. But no, the Indian agent at the time I was elected chief, we in effect pushed him out. And he went to the office of the government, Indian Affairs Department, I should say, in Winnipeg. And because he felt so unwelcome in our office.
Was that the beginning of the end of Indian agents?
In our community.
But in general?
I think there was the movement that was just beginning, where our people made certain assertions to controlling our own destiny.
You know, as you say this, I'm thinking back to 1920. If you look at, there's a very famous, infamous quote from Duncan Campbell Scott, who was the Superintendent General of Indian Affairs. I'm going to quote it so I don't get it wrong. Wanting to get rid of the Indian problem. Our objective is to continue until there is no Indian question and no Indian department. So how did that negative tone and that objective impact the lives? I mean, it couldn't have been a secret. You're saying when you became chief, you people recognized the fact that it was time to reclaim your own story, your own lives. This man, his job is to completely eradicate the Indian problem.
He was the one that pushed the legislation that didn't allow First Nations people or Indigenous people to raise money on land claims to fight
or
the government stealing their land or hiring a lawyer. So he was also in charge of Indian residential schools. And what's interesting about Duncan Campbell Scott is that he's a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada, which is one of the highest honors that one can receive. And the reason he was made a fellow was because of his poetry. He was a poet. And guess what the theme of his poetry contributions were? The theme was the saga, the sad tale of the disappearing Indian. And here he was, the architect of this legislation, devastating legislation for land and the rightful ownership of the land and everything that meant, as well as the running of the Indian residential schools where kids were, well, we all know the story of that, where the kids were dying, the kids were being abused, the kids were suffering from lack of food and clothing and nutrition and health care. This was the same guy.
And we are going to, that obviously is a big part of this conversation as we move forward on the journey. But I have to ask Phil, given what we know about the Indian Act, Yes, there's been amendments, but why does it still exist today? Why do indigenous people want to keep this document?
Well, I have to make this one statement first. The Indian Act is a racist document. It's the only legislation of its kind in the world that speaks to a distinct peoples, a race of peoples.
It is our apartheid document, essentially. That's
essentially
what you're saying.
And in spite of the underlying theme of the Indian Act, which is about agency, which is about control, which is about dominion over our lands and our peoples, there are many in our community that see the Indian Act as something important. When I was Grand Chief in Manitoba and National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, I made an offer, if I can put it that way, because I didn't have any inherent power, but I proposed that we take steps to repeal the Indian Act in Manitoba, one, because we had an agreement with the federal government, where one of the opportunities we had, one of the options we had, was the repeal of the Indian Act. And I made a similar move nationally when I was national chief. In Manitoba, I recall one meeting. I have a distinct memory of that, a room full of people that were gathered to talk about the dismantling of the Indian affairs, including the Indian Act. We were going to take over control of our affairs. And a woman in the audience got up and said, if we get rid of the government, if we get rid of the Department of Indian Affairs, who's going to look after us? I said, look, we will. The treaties never said we weren't going to look after ourselves or we didn't have the right to do so. That is our right. We will look after ourselves.
But that comment is so incredibly revealing of what the perception was. She said it out loud, but clearly it still exists. So there must be a broader sense of that the government is looking after.
Well, that's the prevailing attitude, in my view, in too many of our communities. We're dependent on government. We're too dependent on government. And that's what poverty does to a people's dependency.
So part of this whole conversation, series of conversations, is to go to a future where that may not be as damning, as obvious, as real. Kathleen, how do you see, as a lawyer, taking the Indian Act, changing it, moving forward so that there isn't that level of dependency and poverty?
Well, I think, like Phil says, people see protection in the Indian Act. It wasn't all negative. There are some positive provisions, like there's the taxation provision, which if you're working on reserve, you get relief from income taxation.
So you don't pay tax
if you're working on reserve and you're earning
mm-hmm.
money on reserve. There's other protections, there's structural things that people feel comfortable with. So if one were to just pull all of that away all of a sudden, I mean, it gives people a sense of insecurity. So there has to be something to replace it. It just can't be dissolved
but it's,
without
it's,
something to replace it.
You know, considering it was written in 1876, yeah. It's not all of a sudden that these conversations yeah. have happened.
Well, and it's happening. It's not that nothing is happening, Lisa. It's happening because it's happening in a different vein. It's happening through modern negotiation of treaties and land claims negotiations. And so Indigenous peoples are now taking back a lot of the power that was denied them through these modern treaties. Now, if you look at Nunavut, for example, or you look at the Nisga Treaty, these are modern treaties where the governments are recognized as governments, and they're especially Nunavut. They have their own parliament. They make their own laws. the vast majority of people in the North in that territory are indigenous. So it makes sense that they would self-govern and be self-determining. But until the Nunavut Treaty was signed, bureaucrats in Ottawa ran those, that huge territory. So things are changing, but in different ways.
For example, one of the most important changes is that First Nation communities can decide for themselves how they will elect their leadership. And so many First Nation communities have opted for custom of the band. There's a provision in the Indian Act that enables First Nation communities to, through custom, elect their leadership. But that provision still has to be sanctioned by the Minister of Indian Affairs. So what we have now is between 50 and 60% of all First Nation communities in the country elect their chief and council by custom of the band. So that's progress, significant progress. But why isn't it that all First Nation communities in Canada aren't able to elect their people by custom? Whatever the custom of the band may be, and it varies from band to band or tribe to tribe.
Now, there was a halt in that custom during the years of the ban in the Act of these cultural events, of the celebration of
Potlatch, the Sundance.
I don't want us to skip over that, because I do think it's really important to look at a 20-year span, or how many years was it, 30, where this was illegal to celebrate publicly any cultural event.
Well, I mean, the authorities, the federal authorities, saw the potlatch as contrary to the will of government, right? And because potlatches were giveaways, where someone accumulated riches and wealth, but then gave it all away, and yet the deep thinkers in Ottawa saying, "Hey, that's socialism."
Riches and wealth from where, though?
Wealth from that they've accumulated. If they were outstanding hunters or fishermen, the West Coast was largely fishing. So, and you had these alliances, you had traders.
So that made the government nervous.
Oh. Well, because, yeah, it was anti-capitalist. They were trying to develop capitalism, of course.
What part of it was also to try to deny any kind of cultural...
That too.
Celebrations.
Well, the Sundance, which is really the Circe dance, was just not consistent with the teachings of the churches. It was inconsistent with the will of government that Indians should be practicing something that is so depraved, depravity, where, people would allow themselves to be tethered to pole in the center with, piercing the skin and dancing till they were able to break free from being tethered. And government saw this as part of the savagery of the indigenous peoples. And this kind of practice should not be allowed and was not allowed. But times have changed. And so you have Sundances that are held in so many places in the country, here and to the south, and where our people, our participants, our organizers, leading, in fact, these incredible celebrations, these very important cultural expressions of various of our people.
Because it is now incumbent on you to teach younger generations who didn't know it. And I mean, that the key provision of the Indian Act really was assimilation, which of course then spelled out the creation of residential schools. And that is where we are going to take our next conversation. Ooh, where,
away, 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 away,